The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. Century of Lies is a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Last weekend, I attended a networking rally in Portland, Oregon, organized by the Minority Cannabis Business Association. Brought back some good audio for you. Let's get straight to it. With the Minority Cannabis Business Association networking rally here in Portland, Oregon, and speaking with Charlo Green. Charlo, tell our listeners a little bit about your story, how you got here.
Well, I was working as a news anchor and journalist for some time. I learned about the real harm that prohibition was causing as a reporter in Anchorage, Alaska, and I decided to use the access that I had to create Alaska's first safe access point for patients, the Alaska Cannabis Club. And as we grew, and I was the weed lady by night and reporter by day, it just wasn't sustainable, and I knew I had to choose. And it became really, really clear to me that I had become a journalist so I could be led to cannabis activism. And so I decided to step away from my job, my career, my life as I knew it, very publicly. And I did so on live TV in September of 2014. And since then, I've been advocating for cannabis reform, advocating for greater diversity in the industry that we're forming now, and just really fighting for freedom and fairness.
Of course, you're now part of the Minority Cannabis Business Association. That's this event here. What's your role with MCBA?
Well, I'm on the board of directors, and I have been for some time. And so we're all working together. We're all different pieces of the puzzle nationally, soon internationally, just throwing together what is it that we need to address as far as education, social justice, what are the needs of communities of color, and what can we do as people that are aware and that are in the industry, what can we do to connect those dots? So that's what I'm here doing. As an individual, what I bring to the table is my ability to have these sorts of conversations and to help facilitate conversations and to bring these sorts of things to light.
Now, there are going to be other networking rallies. I was on your website. You have other events going on. Are you going to have more of these around the West Coast, around the country? What's happening?
Well, all around the country. Our next event is planned for Northern California, right around the NCIA, National Cannabis Industry Association Business Summit in Oakland. So I believe that's June 22nd. Head to minoritycannabis.org to double check that. But we plan on having a number of these events. I also have been organizing events where other members of Minority Cannabis Business Association have been attendance, like the Cannabis Diversity Summit we held in Denver, Colorado. That was a huge turnout. We had a panel of industry leaders, all from communities of color, so it was the first time people that look like me got to see us represented and in a form and fashion that was aspirational. And so it's great that Jesse is doing that here, and I look forward to helping him and having him help me. And Go Green and the Minority Cannabis Business Association are working hand in hand to just reach out and welcome as many diverse people into the industry while we still have a chance and a space.
Terrific. Any closing thoughts for the listeners? I know there's a lot of people who probably like to talk to you.
Well, I plan on talking to a lot of these people on my own show, charlogreen.com. You can find out more information about Charlo's Place, my talk show focused on exploring the world in weed. We're just getting started, so make sure that you tune in and check out what's really happening with the industry. It's a lot of fun. We have these different guests come over to my place, and we have a chef cook up some really great cannabis-infused food for them, or we might be heading over to the dab bar or farming my plants, because I need some help with that too. It's just a more intimate look at what's going on, so there isn't all that stigma and fear surrounding it. So that's Charlo's Place, and again, charlogreen.com is where you can find out more on that.
Terrific. Charlo Green, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That again was an interview with Charlo Green. You can find out more about her at charlogreen.com. That's charlogreene.com. We're here at the Minority Cannabis Business Association networking rally in Portland. I'm speaking with my friend Leland Berger. Lee, you were talking about some of the criminal law developments and especially about criminal record expungement. Could you give folks a quick primer on criminal record expungement?
Well, we've been able to accomplish in Oregon a thing that even the New York Times noticed, that anybody with any prior marijuana conviction is now able to expunge it. And the thinking was, as explained by Representative, soon-to-be State Senator Lou Frederick, that, well, you know, why should you be convicted of something that's now legal? And removing the prior convictions through a motion to set aside the record of the arrest and the conviction can help people who are applying for worker permits under the OLCC rules for the adult use system, or for or people who are applying for licenses as well.
And so, criminal record expungement, you apply to the court, petition the court, and they erase your record?
Well, what they do is they seal the record, they direct the record of your arrest and conviction to be sealed. They instruct the state police and the local police agencies to remove it from the database. If you go online to the court databases and you search for the person's name, it's no longer there. If you call the court clerk, they say, we don't have a file for that person. It works well like that. Where it's problematic is that a lot of employers rely on these businesses that mine public data, and they don't always catch up with this kind of a change. So an employer could be checking with an agency that hasn't looked at the records that shows that you were able to seal the arrest and conviction record.
And then there's things like these mugshot state websites. I mean, it wouldn't take you off of one of those, would it, or would it?
No, the mugshot websites is a thing that you have to handle individually. It's an unfortunate reality, but what you would need to do is send a copy of the order setting aside the record of arrest and conviction to the website and demand that they delete it from the server.
Well,
kind of
okay.
Like a Hillary tweet, right? Delete this account.
Okay. Any thoughts for the listeners?
Well, I think that the next session is going to be interesting because at least Portland Normal is going to be moving forward to try to be a part of an effort to end cannabis bigotry and to amend the Indoor Clean Air Act to allow the clubs to reopen, and also to create temporary event permits, so that we can go to events and cannabis can be distributed. It's kind of interesting to be in this room, which historically was where Oregon Normal handed out medical cannabis to patients for all those years. A lot of cannabis left this room for patients. So anyway, it's great seeing you, Doug. Thanks.
Leland, thank you, brother.
You're welcome.
That was an interview with my good friend Leland Berger. Lee Berger is an attorney in Portland, Oregon. I'm at the Minority Cannabis Business Association networking rally in Portland, speaking with Jesse Horton. Jesse, you're the founder and chairman of MCBA, right?
That's correct, Doug. I am a co-founder and the chairman of Minority Cannabis Business Association.
Right on. I've talked to a few of the folks, a couple of your other board members, but tell me about the MCBA. Why'd you do it?
Yeah, sure, Doug. Well, I got into the industry myself after leaving the engineering profession, and saw the lack of diversity, right? The lack of people that I could reach out to directly about specific issues that people of color face in the cannabis industry. So as I started to realize the dynamic and the different things that were holding people back, I realized, you know, not only was that going to be a problem for the industry from a viewpoint or perspective, and understanding that this cannabis prohibition has been used in so many different ways to target minorities and to keep them down, and that type of perspective as the industry is growing is not good. But also what I realized was that from an economic standpoint, the industry was missing out. From communities of color, they were starting to get more bitter, right, about the cannabis industry, that not only do they not have a chance to benefit or be a business owner or sometimes even have a job in the cannabis industry because of different things that have happened historically, but also they weren't seeing the benefits in their community. They would see dispensaries that were moving in and nobody worked in those dispensaries that looked like them, or nobody owned those dispensaries, or that dispensary wasn't allocating any of that profit back to that community to help. And in making those communities even more bitter about cannabis and about prohibition, we're missing out on the opportunity to grow a diverse list of business owners, to grow a diverse list of employees. And as Sarah Batterby, who was here speaking today, said that diversity most certainly means more dollars. Diversity most certainly means good business. And in looking at the overall business and health of the industry and sustainability, diversity has to be a cornerstone.
So how has the how's MCBA been doing?
We've been doing fantastic. So we started in October, where we brought on some board members who we knew had unique perspectives into what was happening across the country. Because these different pieces of legislation in different cities and different states happened so differently, we wanted to have a perspective and a viewpoint on exactly how that was working. So we brought on new board members in October. We brought in a full slate of 15 board members. And then we launched the organization in April. Once we had an idea of what type of programs we wanted to develop, what type of companies wanted to work with us, right, and we were able to really provide value to the members, then we launched the organization on 4/20 of this year. And since then, we have 900 members who have signed on, mostly individual members who want to learn about how the cannabis industry can benefit either their economic potential or their day-to-day life.
So you have a business here in Portland, right?
Yeah, I do. I have a business in Portland, a cultivation facility called Panacea Valley Gardens, as well as a dispensary that I'm partnered with some great people called Panacea.
Terrific. And how's business?
You know, business is great, I think. Not so much from a money-making standpoint because of the different things we have to deal with tax codes and the fact that we're just getting started from an adult use standpoint. However, it's been excellent in the ability to make a little money, be able to pay my bills, but be able to help a lot of people not only benefit from cannabis but benefit from the industry. So everything's been fantastic.
Cool. Curious, do you think you're going to go with the adult use market, or do you plan to stay with medical, or maybe both?
You know, I think both. That's a good question. I have some really amazing medical patients who need assistance and who are really relying on us. I want to make sure that we can continue to serve them in a way that is affordable and that's beneficial for them. And also beneficial for the people who are running that facility. So we're going to keep a portion of our facility medical. And what we may do is we actually just close on another building where we're going to open that up as an adult use facility. So we'll stay both.
Where can people find out more about Minority Cannabis Business Association? And, of course, do you have any closing thoughts for the listeners?
Yeah, of course. If you want to learn more about MCBA, please go to minoritycannabis.org. We also have an Instagram account, Minority Cannabis, Twitter, and Facebook. And the last thing that I really want to say is that, and I said it earlier today, is that this business, even though we exist to increase the number of people of color in the industry, ultimately for the purpose of improving the industry as a whole, it won't be done without everyone. We need, and as you can see in the room, there was a large diversity of people who are both very involved in the cannabis industry or who don't have any knowledge of the cannabis industry. And we understand that this industry is birthed from activists, from people who understand an injustice and who want to work to do the right thing. So even though we're the Minority Cannabis Business Association, it's going to take the majority, it's going to take the minority, it's going to take everyone to make this industry not just another industry, but a better industry.
Jesse, I just wish you all the luck in the world. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Doug. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for KBOO and all the sponsors here tonight. We wouldn't have been able to do it without you.
That was Jesse Horton. He is a co-founder of the Minority Cannabis Business Association. Before him, you heard Charlo Green and Leland Berger. I spoke with all of them at a networking rally in Portland, Oregon that was organized by the Minority Cannabis Business Association. For more information, check out their website at minoritycannabis.org. You're listening to Century of Lies, a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The U.S. Senate's Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee recently held a roundtable discussion titled America's Insatiable Demand for Drugs, Examining Alternative Approaches. The senators heard from a few really smart, articulate people, as well as one prohibitionist who'd been part of the drug czar's office during the Bush administration. Let's hear from some of the smart, articulate ones. First, here's Dr. D. Scott McDonald, a physician from Canada who's one of the researchers looking into heroin maintenance. Dr. McDonald is introduced by Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican from Wisconsin.
One thing I'd be remiss in my opening statement, I just want to lay out a couple facts. The U.S. has spent an estimated $1 trillion on the war on drugs over the last 40 years. There are roughly 27 million illegal drug users in the U.S. In 2014, there were 47,000 drug overdoses, an average of 129 people per day. So it gives you kind of the magnitude of the problem. On an annual basis, we probably spent about $31 trillion on the war on drugs, and you know, certainly my conclusion would be is we're not winning that war. So this is really about looking at different approaches. I had a nephew who died of a fentanyl overdose in January, so this affects every community in America. And with that, again, I want to thank the witnesses. I know this has been kind of on again, off again. I know, Dr. McDonald, you had probably a pretty fun flight. I love those red eyes myself, so I truly, truly appreciate you doing that. And we'll start off with Dr. McDonald. Would like to give you guys, you know, about 5 minutes to do an opening statement, then we'll kind of get into a free-flowing discussion. But our first witness is Dr. Scott McDonald. He's a physician lead at the Providence Crosstown Clinic in downtown Vancouver, British Columbia. Crosstown is the only clinic in North America providing opiate-assisted treatment for people with severe opiate use disorders. Dr. McDonald.
Thank you.
Did you fly in this morning?
I flew in this morning, yes.
Make sure your microphone is on.
Can I get you a cup of coffee?
I'll pinch him.
At Providence Crosstown Clinic, 100...
Push it right next to your mouth there.
Go like this and see if it...
140 people are receiving daily treatment with injectable opioids, an intensified form of medication-assisted treatment. And I want to thank the government of British Columbia for supporting our clinic and making the delivery of this treatment possible in Vancouver. About half are receiving treatment with hydromorphone, a widely available licensed pain medication. The remainder receive diacetylmorphine. Our patients can come up to 3 times a day for treatment. Half come twice per day and the other half come 3 times a day. About a third take a small dose of methadone with their last session at night. All these patients have a chronic disease, a medical condition for life that can be successfully managed. Treatment prevents withdrawal and stabilizes their lives. Here they have an opportunity to deal with underlying psychological and mental health issues. In time, some will step down to less intensive treatments or gradually wean themselves off. These patients were all participants in Salome, the study to assess longer-term opioid medication effectiveness. Salome was a follow-up to NAOMI, the North American Opioid Medication Initiative, which showed that diacetylmorphine, or prescription heroin, is superior to methadone in that group of patients who continue to use illicit heroin despite attempts at the standard treatments. A small group of NAOMI folks received hydromorphone, and in a surprise finding, these experienced drug users could not distinguish which treatment they received, and the beneficial treatment effect was preserved in the hydromorphone arm. Some people suffering from severe opioid use disorder need an intensified treatment like this. While methadone and buprenorphine are effective treatments for many people and should remain the first-line responses, no single treatment is effective for all individuals. Every person left untreated is at high risk for serious illness and premature death. Despite positive results for diacetylmorphine published in the New England Journal of Medicine, only Denmark acted on these results and incorporated prescription heroin into their health system. But it did lead to our follow-up study and testing of hydromorphone or Dilaudid as a potential treatment. And hydromorphone has the advantage over diacetylmorphine of already being a licensed pharmaceutical. The Salome group underwent stringent testing and controls to show need for treatment. For them, the standard treatments Suboxone and methadone had not worked, and most had multiple prior attempts at treatment. They had used injectable opioids for at least 5 years, and on average 15 years. They had medical and psychological health problems. They had nearly universal involvement in the criminal justice system. In short, we were able to recruit those patients appropriate for an intensified treatment like this. At the start of the study, they were using illicit opioids every day, and by 6 months, their use was down to just 3 to 5 days per month. 3 to 5 days per month. Nearly 80% were retained in care, and that high rate continues to this day. At outset, they were engaged in illegal activities on average 14 days per month, and with treatment that reduced to less than 4 days. This study was published this past April in the Journal of the American Medical Association Psychiatry. And I'd like to acknowledge Health Canada for allowing us to investigate this important scientific question and allowing for a number of our patients to continue on diacetylmorphine, those who need it on a compassionate basis. Supervised injectable hydromorphone is indicated for the treatment of severe opioid use disorder. And we are using injectable hydromorphone as a medication-assisted treatment, an intensified medical intervention as part of the treatment continuum. Severe opioid use disorder is a chronic disease that needs to be managed long-term, just like type 2 diabetes or hypertension. Without our treatment, this group's only option would be illicit opioids through the narco-capitalist networks. We still have people who use drugs on the street in Vancouver, but we have another option in addition to needle exchanges, supervised consumption rooms. Supervised consumption rooms or injection sites. These are legally protected places where drug users consume pre-obtained illicit drugs in a safe, non-judgmental environment. Vancouver has two such sites. These sites provide an important entry point for people into medical care and substance treatment. They also provide value over needle exchanges alone, as needles and equipment are all contained on site, and needles will not end up in playgrounds or schoolyards where they could cause injury. To contrast with these harm reduction interventions, our clinic, Crosstown, we are providing a medical treatment, providing injectable medication in a specialized opioid clinic under supervision of medical professionals, not only ensuring safety of the patients and the community, but we also provide comprehensive care. We are able to use hydromorphone off-label in Canada for treatment of substance use disorder, but some jurisdictions restrict its use to pain. I have seen remarkable transformations in our patients. Some of our patients have already returned to work or school. Supervised injectable hydromorphone is safe, effective, cost-effective. It's a useful tool when the standard treatments are not effective. Treatments are dispensed within our opioid treatment clinic and prescribed on a dispensing basis on-site. In this setting, hydromorphone is not susceptible to diversion, and an exemption for its use could be considered in jurisdictions where its use to treat substance use disorder is prohibited by law. In British Columbia, we need every tool in the toolkit to rise to this challenge of opioid epidemic. Injectable opioid-assisted treatment in supervised clinic is one effective approach. Supervised consumption rooms like Insight in Vancouver are valuable for public health. Of course, we would like to see an end to people dependent on heroin. But for those already suffering, it is essential to provide care and care based on evidence.
That was Dr. Scott McDonald, a Canadian physician and researcher, speaking before the U.S. Senate's Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Now let's hear an exchange between Senator Kelly Ayotte, a Republican from New Hampshire, and Arlington, Massachusetts Police Chief Frederick Ryan.
What can we do? We're supporting the CARA efforts that I think are, we need to expand the treatment of those who are, and the demand side.
Right.
I just, Chief, I don't know what your thoughts.
Yeah, you know, in Massachusetts, under Governor Baker's leadership, we've got the State Without a Stigma campaign, which has been incredibly effective. One of our treatment providers is the face of the State Without a Stigma campaign, coming from the governor's office. That messaging was huge in terms of us going out and having dialogue at community meetings and people saying, hey, this is coming from the governor's office. This is important stuff. You know, and it further
illustrates. Let me say I admire Governor Baker's leadership on this, and I thank him.
I do, too. He's been incredibly effective, and he invited Chief Campanella to I when he signed the legislation. But, you know, we can't keep drugs out of our prisons. You know, if we think we're going to keep it off the streets of America through heavily weighted enforcement priorities, we've simply got it wrong. And so it speaks to the need for treatment and prevention. And I've learned a lot during this process. And the other notion that we need to have a bed for everybody, you know, and that goes with the stigma too. I need to be in some bed somewhere in some institution because I have this substance use disorder.
You have a lot of medication-assisted treatment. Well, that isn't institutionalized.
And that's where I was going with this. You know, and the physicians can speak to this better than I can. But as I understand it, the one addiction that's most likely to respond to a medication-assisted treatment is an opiate addiction. And we've seen with Vivitrol, like the senator mentioned it, incredible effectiveness. And we've partnered with a Vivitrol clinic. One of the challenges there, and one of the things you know your committee might be able to look at, is it's incredibly expensive. And so we've got patients that we've got into a Vivitrol clinic, and they go for many, many months, and they're over the physical addiction. Now this has become sort of a bit of a crutch, you know, and get weaning them back off of Vivitrol is becoming challenging as well.
We also have caps on certain forms of treatment as well that need to be addressed that we've pushed. I just want to make sure that as I look at, to your point, Dr. Murray, you know, 1 gram of fentanyl is the equivalent, according to the CDC, of 7,000 street doses of heroin. So this obviously is a very, very powerful synthetic drug. The drug deaths in my state are being driven by fentanyl. I mean, that is where we've seen a market losing a person a day by the fentanyl. And as we talk about increasing the efforts on treatment, and I'm obviously, I wouldn't have led the effort on CARA with great people like Rob, and prevention, which I think is key, and we have not invested enough in that. We need to invest more. Chief, I know you want that to be your emphasis, and I'm with you. And I've got my local chief from Nick Willard, who's the chief in our largest city, Manchester, who's a great guy, and he'll say the same thing to me. But also he'd say to me, I don't want you to totally give up on the demand. And so whether it's the fentanyl piece or – so I hope we're not saying that we're not going to totally abandon our demand efforts, but we need to do more focus on the treatment.
That was from a U.S. Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee roundtable discussion on drug use in America. In that last segment, we heard New Hampshire Senator Kelly Ayotte, Arlington, Massachusetts Police Chief Frederick Ryan, and Ethan Nadelman, Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. And, well, that's it for today. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Century of Lies, a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The Drug Truth Network is on Facebook. Please give its page a like. Drug War Facts is on Facebook, too. Give it a like and share it with friends. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back next week with 30 minutes of news and information about the drug war and this century of lies. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.